Good evening and welcome. March 25th, 2022. Yeah, just let me know if I'm coming through in the chat, if you can hear me. Oh, we start that way. Good. Yeah, so today we need to get to the foundations of globalization, multipolarity, the Great Reset, what this coronavirus shutdown was all about going back to spring, early spring of 2020, 2 years ago. It's hard to believe it's been that long. But what's often misunderstood and what we need to understand is that what is happening is not the optimum plan. It was not the optimal plan of the elites. They did not want this. Now they throw a bunch of things out at the same time. They talk their book. I meant to do that. This was our plan all along. Then they deploy their flying monkeys throughout the conspiracy theory sphere. There's people already preconditioned, people, emotionally reactive people, paranoid people, reactive people, people with an overblown sense or understanding of the power that the Atlanticist elite have. They think that they rule the world. And who benefits the most from that view? Setting aside whether it's true or not, because it's not. But who benefits the most from that view? A funny thing, you know, people used to say back in the old neighborhood, you used to have these local mafiosi. And they might collect a debt a certain way, break an occasional leg, bust some kneecaps. And this would send a message loud and clear, far beyond the reaches of the real ability to break everyone's knee who didn't pay their debts. Just it projected enough. That's the gargoyle effect. Now, what you have with the clinical psychopathy of the ruling class is an inability to be wrong, an inability to let anyone think beneath them. They've got lots and lots of tiers of power and there's a large bureaucracy. They can't let people think that they've lost this thing, that things are spinning out of control. But that's precisely the message that they need to promote, that they are in control. And the more that you believe that they are in control, the more that you believe it, the more that it's true. And they love it. When you go out there working for free, to promote that they're in control and that every move and counter move, everything you do against them, they're the ones actually getting you to do that against them, because then the thing they do in response is the justification. We already explained before that it doesn't work that way at this level. It's amazing, really, but it's understandable. We've talked about this before, how it is, why people understand power this way, because we as the plebeians, as the peasants, as the peasants, as the proletariat, as the déclassé, as les miserables, as the deplorables, we are out there and we observe in our lives that power works this way. the judge is in cahoots with the bank, is in cahoots with your employer, is in cahoots with your landlord, is in cahoots with the city council. Of course. Left and right, Democrat, Republican, one large staged inter-paradigm fight. Of course, that's true. But the world is a real big fucking place. A real big fucking place. It ain't small. They've been promoting this view that it's a small world after all. They've been promoting that view. To limit your horizons, to shrink your understanding of the vast size of this world and all of the things that are possible in it and how little of it they actually control. And another thing to keep in mind is, while I believe that human beings have nearly unlimited potential for growth and development at any given time in this paradigm, the average IQ is about 100. They aren't creating these elaborate plots that make it look like they're losing control when they're really in control, or they're not involved at this level in trying to convince people. One in 10,000, one in 100,000 people whose IQ pops over 120 or 130, it's just not what they need to worry about. The message just is the message, oftentimes. They're not totally in control of all of these things. And when they project this sort of gargoyle thing of lockstep, it's an illusion. It's hyper-reality. Hyperreality is a critical component of hybrid warfare, the information warfare part. Now, I think a lot of things can be drawn from fourth generation warfare, the theory of fourth generation warfare, but hybrid war involves a lot of information war stuff, but fourth generation warfare does too. Lynn's work, Frank's work. So, this is how they create a simulacrum. This was based on their own theories. The ruling class has spent billions of dollars on certain areas of the humanities and social sciences, in the areas of sociology and philosophy, and they've promoted certain views. Now, the students coming through those institutions believe that they were like protesting it. They believe that they were like opposing the system. But actually, the way the system works is it takes the ideas of opposition. It takes the ideas of opposition and criticism of the system and then incorporates them into the theories that reinforce the system. Because the people who were so motivated to develop the theories that could deconstruct the system also were instructing the system on how to become smarter. So where does this concept of globalization come in? We just saw Larry Fink say that, and he's Vanguard, or one of the public faces, what is it, the BlackRock group. They He said globalization has come to an end because Vladimir Putin ended it by going into Ukraine. Of course, it wasn't, you know, they want to blame this thing they love so much, globalization. And in my book review, when I showed you 15, 20 titles that that formed the foundation of the World Economic Forum's view, at least it's a very impartial list, only focusing on the work of Jeremy Rifkin and a few others, Wallerstein, many Marxist, neo-Marxist, structuralist, post-structuralist, Michel Foucault, Louis Althusser, Foucault's work developing on Nietzsche and Jeremy Bentham on the Panopticon. I've documented all of this. I've spent thousands of hours of research. And I'm highly motivated and compelled to share this with the public, at least those who can understand and hear it. The coronavirus pandemic has shown that the twin processes of globalization and planned obsolescence are deficient and moribund. Globalization was predicated on a number of assumptions, including the perpetuity of consumerism and the withering away of national boundaries as transnational corporations so required it to be. What we see instead is not a globalization process, but a process of rising multipolarity and a rethinking of consumerism itself. Now, this much has been in opposition to their plans. Of course, they have been seeing for the past 5 to 15 years with increasing doubt, and their doubts increasing until they pushed the great reset button with the pandemic. Of course, they could see that and began to try to recalibrate their plans, but those were not the optimal plans. And they have, being nevertheless still part of a contingency, they're the less optimal and either have the lower chance of success, and or the success is a compromised position. They were trying to build a new world order, a one world government. This was through very non, we don't have to talk about any conspiratorial secret societies or organizations. That misses the point. That mystifies things. That makes things abstract. This is through the United Nations, through NGOs that work through the funding by philanthropists, people with names. We don't have to look at secret handshakes, and we can. That stuff's also there. But is he relevant to understanding at this level? That, what we are seeing, was not their plan. They need to make it look like their plan, because even during their highest position of power, they didn't have absolute power. And who is they? This is not a conspiracy of people who are in love with each other. These are the same type of self-minded, ego-driven sociopaths that would stab their own mother in the back. George Soros, an admitted, confessed Nazi war criminal who 25 years ago interviewed, what was it, ABC or 60 Minutes? And he says, and the guy goes, oh, do you have regrets? He goes, not at all. If it wasn't me, it would have been someone else. And therefore, in essence, it wasn't me. Wow. And we're supposed to believe that they are all birds of a feather in the sense that they have each other's back. No, they are constantly waiting to stab each other in the back. They are constantly looking for someone to break ranks or for something not to work so that they can emerge from the shadow and say, aha, the plan is not working like you said, and we were behind you, and now it's failing, and now you are no longer. It's like in the Dark Crystal. Remember those, what are they called? Those ones, those rapidly aging old bird lizard creatures that suck the souls out of the little, what are they called, Gelflings or whatever? And they're constantly looking, and they're each ego-driven Machiavellian machinations. This is not, they're not all on the same team, guys. Their own existence is their own undoing. So, of course they claim about rethinking consumerism and you'll own nothing and be happy. This is something like Plan D or Plan E. But we can explain that. Normally, a total market crash and unemployment crisis would usher in a period of militant labor activity. Remember labor unions? There'd be strikes, walkouts, community labor campaigns. Now, we've seen some of this already, except it didn't come from the traditional labor union bureaucracy. It didn't come from the labor aristocracy. It didn't come from the Democrat Party, SEIU channels of power. But that medical state of emergency that they declared, it effectively worked like a lockout. What's a lockout? Well, you know, we can threaten to do a trucker convoy, to refuse to go to work if we're forced vaccinated, wear masks, whatever, right? But employers can do a lockout, which is like doubling down. Like, you think you're going to go on strike? Well, we are locking you out. So they did the economic crash and then the lockout, which was the lockdown. Remember that? See, we are going back 2 years ago and walking through the chronology of this shit, because it matters. The cause and effect matters. They're going to try to go back and make the cause look like it came after the effect. And they constantly flip the script like that. So instead of workers demanding a restoration of wages and hours and workplace rights, people were clamoring for any chance to work at all under any conditions handed down. Elites can afford to do this because they were given trillions of dollars during that bailout. You see how that works? But let's back up a little bit, because we talk about the economy. And all of our lives, we've been misinformed over what a growing economy actually means, what it looks like. How do we identify it? All of our lives have been lied about what technical improvement literally means. You see, a growing economy means that all goods and services become less expensive. And that cuts against inflation. You see, rather instead, all prices should be deflating. Less money ought to buy the same, or the inverse. The same money ought to buy more. Technical innovation means that goods should last longer, not have shorter lifespans. Now, of course, what they've done is sort of done many tricks towards this planned obsolescence by calling it improved features or additional features. And they tried to plan the obsolescence through advertising that you don't want the old one anymore, that it doesn't have certain features. They build things missing features that you want. You buy it for the status, and then you buy the next one because it finally has a feature that it was supposed to have in the first place. But now, when we think about employment, that's not actually a bad thing if everyone was becoming unemployed roughly in proportion. What do I mean by that? Well, I mean, if today you have to work 10 hours a day to buy the same things, if the economy was actually growing, you should be able to have the same amount of money and buy the same things after 8 hours and then 7 hours and then 6 hours and 5 hours. You see, that's what technological development means. When they say the economy is growing, except we need to go into an additional round of austerity and now we all have to work longer and retirement should be an older age and benefits should be cut more, like they've got people fighting against each other between abstractions about the state versus markets and you should work and nothing's for free. And all of this has been a virtual hyper-reality economy this whole time. They can turn the spigot on or off. The wealth has been redistributed upwards. Nothing natural about that. So now, an April 2nd BBC article from the year 2020, or I think it was actually, it was 2020, was titled, "Will Coronavirus Reverse Globalization?" And in this one, it was proposed that the pandemic exposes the weaknesses and vulnerabilities of a global supply chain and manufacturing system. And that this, in combination with the overarching U.S.-China trade war, would see a general tendency towards re-offshoring of activities. And these are fair points. But that article misses the point of the underlying problem facing economics in general, which is that the more that we automate overall, profit margins decrease. If the economy is really growing, the per unit profit margin decreases. You might call it sort of like the law of diminishing returns, the declining rate of profit, whatever, you know, there's many different terms for this in different schools, but instead we were confronted with these increasingly irrational policies in all spheres. They were being pursued to savage the ultimately unsalvageable. And that's actually where we are. That's where we have been. So the shutdowns, remember this? They were totally unnecessary. In numerous widely esteemed experts in virology and epidemiology, they all came forward and said so. This is not how you handle, you know, where's the public policy component of this? It's not, you know, it's a political decision to do a lockdown. The virus didn't cause things to shut down. Lawmakers caused things to shut down. And you don't just listen to these scientists over here, but you, and even if those scientists were not handpicked by the same people doing the reset, even if they had come up a genuinely independent panel and there was a wide public debate about it, communicability is not the only factor in public policy formation. There's also public administration, private administration, public policy. There's so many different considerations about the impact on employment, et cetera, et cetera. It's like crazy. When we look at the wanton creation of new money to bail out the banks, they're going to hide all that now as being caused by this war. They're going to hide all of that. They're going to sweep that all under the rug of war. This can, they've been kind of kicking down the road for a number of years. I mean, you could go back and back and back and back. You know, each pyramid, each Ponzi scheme, each bubble. 97, 2000, 2001, 2007, 2008, 2019, 2020, that all these Ponzi schemes. But when they made all this money out of thin air, the lockdown was to avoid an inflation and debasement crisis. You see, this has to do with the velocity of money. It's not simply that the money was put on, I say printed out of thin air, but you know, the zeros added to the screen, not even that, but, you know, the zeros added to the screen printed from thin air. But when people were unable to really spend during the lockdown, and the way that they have been financing the dilemmas that arose in terms of the inability to get these lockdowns to stick, especially when the vaccine came out so prematurely, if you look at what they really wanted to have happen, without a vaccine, we would have been in a much worse situation. And that can be hard to understand at first until you realize that every 1% of unemployment in the United States indirectly causes some 30, 36,000 deaths. See, those are the types of things that actual experts in public policy would consider in doing a lockdown. And actually they did, because they knew that if they could extend this for, look, per year, 1%, 36,000, 30, maybe 25 to 35,000 deaths. And that's 1% unemployment. Well, when they first did this thing, when they first decided to collapse this bubble, when they did, they were running out of time. So a decision was made to pull it. And it collapsed in on itself. And unemployment went up to what, 24, 25, 26%. I think Financial Times said 19%. But, you know, unemployment's always been miscalculated, especially in the U.S. So that was going to be 1.1 or 1.2 million deaths per year, just from the economics of the lockdown. And then this whole thing that people are looking at, Vanguard, BlackRock, oh, they're buying up houses and they're overpaying. Well, yeah, they're part of the intelligence. They're effectively part of the owners of the Federal Reserve or a branch of the Federal Reserve themselves. Of course, that's true. But they were looking at taking that 2007 housing market crash with everybody defaulting on loans from that unemployment and buying them at fire sale prices, not 30% over market. Right now, homeowners have built equity. So you have to stop these propagandists. Some know they're doing it, some don't know they're doing it. A lot of these so-called economics blogs that are very popular and promote this stuff are deep state operations to make you think that that what's happening is exactly what the elites wanted to happen, because that's how they gargoyle effect the illusion of total control. So this lockdown, they could have created this money, but with people locked down, it would have kept the velocity of money to a minimum. So in other words, so long as you don't have this chain reaction of transactions and the money stays still, it actually won't cause inflation. Also, this money that sits on these computer screens of the transatlantic banks can't be spent, or it'll tank the system with hyperinflation. You see what's happening now? The rising prices of things have nothing to do with who bought up the land or turning away boats at the docks. Like, those are excuses. Those are distractions. Those are happening, but it's not the point. And it's not the war. It's the money itself. It's not the scarcity of objects, of things. It's the debasement of the currency. So more to the point, this BBC piece that I was referring to had erroneously acclaimed that that it's necessary to continue this production and consumption cycle forever. This is like the karmic wheel of production consumption. That's the entire system that we live. That's the whole paradigm. That's the entire mode of production, that people go to work to make things. They earn money from making things, and with that money, they buy the things that are made. So the elites were not wrong to shut down the cycle per se, because the system can't go on. The problem is that they cannot offer the correct hardware in its place, because it puts an end to the very way that they justify the system and its cycle. And it's this, which in turn is a major source for the maintenance of their dopamine equilibrium and narcissist supply. This is an existential crisis facing the meaning of their lives. A lot of us think that we'd be happy with $1 billion, and that we'd be friends with people that had billions of dollars. This is not how it works. People are always bored. They always burn out their dopamine, adrenaline, serotonin. Meaning and happiness are never bought. They're a liability. Who was it that said that the great landlords of England, with all the properties they had to maintain, actually functioned as little more than custodians? You don't own things. The things own you. Now they're the ones trying to say, you'll own nothing and you'll be happy. And of course, this was not their plan. And of course, they're wrong and you will own things. But your happiness has nothing to do with the things that you own. The things that you own, namely ownership in enterprises, ownership and property, these are the foundations of the single economic unit from which all democratic processes flow. It's impossible to have freedom without having property. And that is true, and yet the elites have perverted that truth as well to justify their own moves to own everything. They are chasing the dragon. They are in search of that ever elusive high. So naturally, their solutions are population reduction and other such quasi-genocidal neo-Malthusian plans, the destruction of humanity, the number one productive potential force, humanity. To destroy humanity resets the hands of time back to a period in the past when profit levels were higher. Do you remember that Instagram campaign where celebrities and elites who didn't have to do the lockdown would take pictures of the city centers without people, and they declared these beautiful and peaceful? Well, to me, it looks like there's been a plague or something. I would wonder, was there a nuclear war, or what, you know, where are the people at? That's what's beautiful to me, is the people interacting with the structures, with the human geography interacting with the architecture. This is an example of the misanthropic principle at play. So you can see that the elites have chosen to shut down the Western economy at this time. It's telling of an historic point that we have reached in the development of the economy and their inability to get this globalization scheme to work. Now, in my book review, I made this like on my bed, ad hoc. I just took a big pile of about 15 or 25 books that are just a fraction of, very important though, of the books necessary to understand their thinking in the Great Reset. All of these transatlantic think tanks between the World Economic Forum and everything from Columbia University and all of these endowments and trusts, they knew that they had to destroy Russia and they had to figure out a way to bring China back to some place like in the 19th century where everyone was just high on opium. How could they get opium back into China? Maybe take control of Afghanistan, get some group of Salafis that are okay with that, make common cause with the Uyghurs who are being Salafized, create a corridor of destabilization throughout China, pop that off in Chechnya, Dagestan, and Russia south, just have destabilized color revolutions and Arab Springs popping off, Belarus, Ukraine, inside of Russia. We know that the mayor of Moscow and his wife very much in bed with the Bidens and the Soroses. You see, Russia is not a dictatorship. It has a lot of different states And they have their own governors and mayors, and Putin is not a dictator. So there are criminals and people trying to do this globalization scheme and get it to take off in Russia, which means breaking Russia apart. Now, they already succeeded in taking off Ukraine, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, et cetera. But they have published their plans to get 10 or 15 more out of that. And it didn't happen. And they needed that to happen. They needed that to happen, particularly if you understand the speculative model of the European Union, which was organized in such a way never to maximize the productive potential of each state, because in their thinking that would lay the material foundation for those states to have material antagonisms between each state, and that would, it would recreate the problems of World War I and World War II. So there's like no connection at all between how each country is allowed to set its prices and the value of labor and its budget, as opposed to what they actually materially produce as consumer goods and services, totally disconnected. But what they were, how they were able to justify a completely notional fiat currency was the idea that future monies would be made as the European Union expanded eastward and eastward and eastward. That's how they understood the European Union. That was the Ponzi scheme of the EU. And that Ponzi scheme stops with the last country that actually can't be added to the EU. Well, they could reimagine what Europe is. Should we allow Turkey? Should we allow Israel? Is Georgia, which side of the Urals Mountains is, you know, what is this concept of Europe? In antiquity, Europe was only the lands of the Holy Roman Empire, which was most of Germany and France. Iberia was a different land. Italy was its own place. And all the lands to the east and southeast, like the Balkans, that was not considered Europe 1,000 years ago. Europa was a tiny place. The concept has grown and grown, but they've reached the limits of growth by territory. And so that Ponzi scheme sort of ends at the Black Sea with Romania, in the Aegean with Greece. Where do you go from there? You got fucking nothing. So globalization, for all these reasons and more, begins to screech to a halt. Now, we also hear, of course, from people like Bill Gates, who we haven't heard from in a long time, that there could be more illnesses and more diseases to come. Now, there's been particular attention on the biolabs making those in Ukraine. Hunter Biden's firm, to the tune of billions and billions of dollars in these biolabs. What were they studying? Well, it looks like the Russians showed receipts at the UN, and they published them for everyone to see, showing the original documents that they seized from these places, from these biolabs, and from employees from biolabs that they were able to reach out to, coerce, cajole, bribe, whatever. It's not hard to, when you're a Ukrainian virologist making $700 a month, and that is three times more than what anyone else is making. And at these labs, they were figuring out how to get viruses carried by bats to infect humans. That's not my supposition. These are in the documents that you can see on Telegram right now. So they had built up this whole theory, and what we need to end at this time is the thinking that globalization was just their ruse or their scam to end globalization or something like that. Why not just not do globalization if multipolarity was their plan? Including UN Agenda 21, which is still pushing global governance. But you have this role of these book-talking philanthropists like Bill Gates, who have this grossly unbalanced degree of power over policy formation in the Western sphere, is really not a problem when you look at what the UN Agenda 21 is. The problem is how the subcommittees have had the language inserting about what that should look like by the World Economic Forum. And then the World Economic Forum actually is creating what that is. But on the UN side, none of those countries are required to fulfill anything. It doesn't really matter when countries come and sit on these committees and panels and talk about Agenda 21. And there's 17 points, and a lot of them are pretty decent. They would have to be, because a lot of countries' representatives from these little developing third world countries, I might be corrupt countries, but at the level of diplomacy at the UN, I mean, they're not bad things per se, but the way that the World Economic Forum twists it becomes crazy. Does that make sense? And it's the World Economic Forum. It's the IMF, the World Economic Forum being the think tank of the IMF. It's the IMF that actually goes in and requires that these countries implement Agenda 21, but the World Economic Forum version of that. You see? But in the place now of this waning globalization, we're seeing the reality of a rising multipolarity. And with this as well, we can see the winding down of the production consumption cycle. Because that cycle had been based upon offshore production and international assembly, and at the root of it all, planned obsolescence towards long-term profitability. There were very big problems with globalization theory, very big problems with globalization theory. Now, without a doubt, globalization theory satisfied aspects of descriptive power. But as time marched forward, its predictive power weakened. What do I mean by that? Well, a theory is only as scientific or good as it is both descriptive and predictive. And when you look at the attempts to build a new world order after the collapse of the USSR, that's when globalization was promoted at all levels. Anyone who went to university from 1994 onwards was exposed to globalization theory. Now, the promotion of globalization theory also raises, ethical problems, of course, like a criminologist describing a crime wave while they themselves are investing into new prison construction, right? Globalization theory was as much a theory as it was a policy forced upon the world by the same institutions behind its popularization in academia and in policy formation. So in terms of a theory, having predictive power is nonsense, because the agents involved in promoting its inevitability were actually working hard to force the result. In other words, not scientific. Not scientific. It's not inevitable. It only happens as the consequence of an agenda being forced and then being written about by those forcing it as though it's both inevitable and natural. That's the entire discourse on globalization. And so there used to be an anti-imperialist left before the whirlwind of wars and confusion, before the gears of diplomacy came to a crashing halt. There was a time in the past and here we are now. Globalization was itself just a rebranding of the Washington Consensus. Neoliberal think tanks and the presumed eternal dominance of institutions like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, which in turn are thinly disguised conglomerates of the largest transatlantic banking institutions. So while globalization was often given a humanist veneer that promised global development, modernization, and they made the end of nation states sound like a good thing because they said that's the source of war, now they say that insurance is the source of war. In reality, globalization was premised on continuing and increasing concentration of capital towards the traditional 19th century zones of power, New York, London, Berlin, and Paris. And anything else was smoke and mirrors. So there used to be these critics of globalization when it was called imperialism. But once the mantra of just putting the word technology before something made it seem like that's the future and it's inevitable, like all these Web3 venture capital firms promoting different crypto technologies based on 1970s primitive stuff, really. And what they did is they spun anti-globalization, which was anti-imperialism, into how to make globalization friendly and nice. So you had books like Global Village or Global Pillage. How about neither Global Village nor Global Pillage? How about that? That's what I want to see. None of those two, none of the above. Is there a third option there? We don't need a global village. Villages are great, but it's also great that villages are different from each other. That's how you don't replicate the same civilization-ending mistake on a global scale. Hundreds of years ago, there used to be liberal thinkers that were smart. Mills was one of them. He called it experiments in living. That's why you have different laws in different states. So what they did is they flipped the discourse on its head. The new left, they transformed anti-imperialism into being critical of globalization by rebranding internationalism as globalization, when really globalization was a rebranding of imperialism. And so the new left was criminal and complicit in this. So all they had to do was call it globalization and show how it's destroying toxic nationalism and creating, what did they call it? Microfinance solutions for women and girls. They trotted out Malala, and it was bought hook, line, and sinker. This was not the new era of globalization, but rather the usual suspects going back to the 19th century. A feel-good rebranding of the very same 19th century imperialism as described by J.A. Hobson's seminal work from 1902, Imperialism. They touted its inevitability, but this wasn't founded on the impossibility of alternate models, but strictly on the authority that flows from gunboat diplomacy. But you see, my friends, sea power has given way to land power. Air forces are no longer effective against anti-air defenses. Countries can defend themselves much more easily than they can conquer other countries. And the sea power model, even though it carried forward through the first decade of the 21st century, all of these were inherited power relationships and inherited power imbalances between the different spheres of the world based upon the power that was inherited from the rise of the great naval powers of the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries. These carried forward just until recently. Multipolarity is the emergent reality. It's already here. And just because there are iterations of it that are poorly understood, doesn't mean that that's what it is. The wrong people have written about it in the wrong way, in an attempt, again, as they always do, just like with the fourth industrial revolution, just like with Internet of Things, just like with 3D printing, they're trying to capture the word so you don't know what it means so that you're against it. They're trying to make multipolarity seem like something else. It actually involves processes with some aspects of globalization theory that the earlier parts of globalization theory, when it actually did have predictive power, but they misunderstood very fundamental things. You see, what is actually emerging are independent blocks in the world, like a Euro-Eurasian sphere, Chinese, Indian, two African spheres, a North American sphere, a Latin American sphere. So it's far more likely that Latin American countries will come together. They are. They have the Mercosur, the Sucre, many different mechanisms. You have global alternatives to the IMF, like BRICS. The thing with globalization theory was that the banks, which had manipulated the vast productive power of the American people, used that wealth-generating machine, captured it, and converted it into both a colonial and imperial model of dominating the world, and then it came to a crashing halt. They are not winning. these are exactly the same type of people that would never admit that they're losing. They would always figure out a way to make it seem like losing is winning, because everything is based in confidence, speculation, the future. They have to make it seem like they meant to do that. The present system is based on a production, consumption, and financial model. The solutions to crises are presented as population reduction, and even in some cases, almost looks like they're trying to do a population displacement or population replacement or population. They're trying to move populations around. But the shutdown, that shutdown, it revealed that this karmic wheel of production and consumption had in truth already been broken. We have already passed the zenith point of what the old paradigm had to offer. It had long since entered into a period of decay, economic and moral destruction. Are you with me? Like the Christ who brings forth a new covenant, or the Buddha who emerges to break the wheel of karma, the new world to be built on the ruins of modernity is a world that liberates the productive forces, realizing their full potential, and with it, the liberation of man from the machine of the production-consumption cycle. It breaks the wheel. It's been planned obsolescence and consumerism that have been the twin evils that have worked towards this time-wasting enslavement of living to work. And it was upon this planned obsolescence model that they built the globalization model based on global assembly and global monoculture. But what's important for people? Do you live to work? Do you work to live? What is it you want to do with your time? And yet, the politicians and economists, when they're talking nice, talk about everyone having a job, as if what people want is to be away from their families and their friends and their passions and truly productive endeavors. People don't want jobs. They want to do something meaningful, and that can be a job. But the idea of job creation is totally at odds with economic development, because economic development, by definition, means less hours of work to produce the same amount of wealth. And everyone says, regardless of income, that they'd be contentedly happier if they made 20 or 30% more. It doesn't even matter how much you make. 20, 30% more, you'd be like, yeah, that's good. So it's in your mind, a lot of it. Planned obsolescence is the key to understanding this thing. When you look at debunking the stated aims of the Great Reset and the Fourth Industrial Revolution, talking about people renting things and how it would pass around. No, no, no. They want to keep control over a system using what Carl Wittfogel called Oriental despotism. That analysis of the hydraulic mode of production. Basically, that despots, if you develop technology in such a way that the regular person's access point goes through a single controlled channel, then the despot controls everything. But if the technology is decentralized, then the level of despotism in that society decreases in proportion to that. They want you, the thinking people, they want you to see the words 3D printing, fourth industrial revolution, Internet of Things, and they want you to define them the way that they have defined them, not what they really mean. And if you learn what they really mean, then you would understand that they have hidden the solution behind the gargoyle. Yeah, I think that just about sums it up. I'm going to call this one.